Have it now, with ice cream and a cherry on top. But I don't want ice cream. I want a world where there is no need for pediatric oncology, UNICEF, military budgets, or suicide rails on the top floors of tall buildings. The world would drip with mercy. Thy kingdom come, I pray, and my heart aches. And my tongue trips over the rest. Thy will be done. And maybe it's one big disappointment. Before I got sick, I visited an actual enactment of what heaven would be like, sponsored by Jan and Paul Crouch, the omnipresent faces of Christian televangelism. This prosperity preaching duo owned the Trinity Broadcasting Network and, among other things, had purchased the Holy Land Experience, a sweet and gaudy biblical theme park devoted to retelling the life of Jesus, if Jesus had lived in Orlando, Florida. I ate a snack at Esther's Banquet Hall and purchased the autobiography of Paul Crouch at the Gold, Frankincense, and Myrrh gift shop. In their recent renovations, they had added a few flourishes, including a dozen cardboard cutouts of Jan Crouch, a tiny grinning woman supporting her trademark purple beehive, pointing guests to various destinations. This way to the Sermon on the Mount at 10:45 a.m. Don't miss the crucifixion at 3 p.m. The death of Jesus was a giant bloodbath, but touchingly portrayed by a man with very soulful eyes. And I did not once question why everyone around me was crying. But when the resurrection sequence began at 4 p.m., and cherubim and seraphim danced around the stage, and solemn angels arrived to let the trumpet sound, I started to feel disappointed in the prospect of heaven. The actor playing Jesus appeared to enormous applause in a white robe with a long purple cape and a heavy gold crown, and paced the stage a few times. But then the music swelled, and Jesus walked through wall-to-wall mirrors misted with the thick white plumes of a fog machine. And I realized that heaven could just be a fog machine in Orlando. The future can seem awfully like the present. I remember standing on a windy hilltop in northern Israel with an elderly woman named Beverly, her shock of dyed red hair as fierce as the way she whispered the name of the ancient site. "Megiddo," she said, "this is everything." She spoke at a frantic pace as her eyes scanned the panoramic view, describing how the end-time armies would do battle below for the future of humankind. She gestured widely at the valleys at our feet. "Megiddo," she said again. In Greek, the mountain went by its more common name, Armageddon, a byword for the end of time. But every time the celebrity pastor we were traveling with uttered a prophecy, telling our assembly in conspiratorial tones that 2025 would bring Jesus back to earth to destroy the wicked and reward the righteous, Beverly tallied it to her life with painful specificity. It was too late. She would not live to see the world undone and remade. And people didn't even want to make the climb. She said it like she wanted to spit. Almost everyone was sitting comfortably in the tour buses below while she and I had made the trek up the mountain alone, her wobbly legs almost buckling by the final steps. Most of them were going to live to see the day, and they didn't even care. At the time I had thought, what an odd duck. Traveling all this way to stand on an apocalyptic mountaintop. Now I understand that she needed the view, her eyes casting beyond her horizon. For a minute there, she needed to live in that beautiful, terrible someday. It is almost summer, but as I am only keeping track of my treatment calendar, It is another Wednesday in Atlanta. I am sitting in another visit to the hospital, waiting for the next scan results. This is the sixth time I've done this, and it doesn't get easier. Deep breath. It's good. I have 2 more months to live. Again. When I was in college, I took a class in the philosophy of religion from a wonderful old scholar, long past retirement age, who had spent his life working on a lovely translation of the Bhagavad Gita, an ancient Sanskrit text that lays out many of the fundamental precepts of Hinduism. But mostly he gave us book after book about Hinduism's understanding of reincarnation, perpetual rebirth into new lives and bodies, and how it had probably already been proven by scientists. But mostly, I remember him because he lost his wife of 50-plus years that semester. Not from disease or old age, but because she was hit by a car crossing the road near our campus. He was so stooped by sadness that he had to stop teaching us. But in his last class, I remember him saying that he couldn't breathe when he found her things around the house. "I found her little sock in the washer today," he said, fat tears rolling down his leathered cheeks. And we all felt sad in that limited way of students too new to the world to know its burdens. He had believed that her life would go on and on, but she had gone on without him. And he was here, stuck in her past. Beverly lived in the apocalyptic future, and the scholar lived in the past. I think I believed that I was living in the center, but I rarely let my feet rest on solid ground, rooting me in the present. My eyes shifted to look for that thing just beyond, the next deadline, the next hurdle, the next plan. "That second baby is going to need his or her own room, so let's talk about renovations." On long walks, I forever roped Tobin into my favorite topic, the next thing. How could we improve our lives? What should we do next? As we walked through the tall Carolina oaks on a fall trail dusted with technicolor leaves, my mind hummed with possible futures. Always. If I were to invent a sin to describe what that was, for how I lived, I would not say it was simply that I did not stop to smell the roses. It was the sin of arrogance, of becoming impervious to life itself. I failed to love what was present, and decided to love what was possible instead. I must learn to live in ordinary time, but I don't know how. There's the gradual, long way up the mountain, and that's the easier way. My oncologist is looking at me sternly, which I know is difficult for him. He's very nice, and this is the closest thing to a lecture he's ever given me. And then there's the steep, fast climb, and that's the harder way. "You've been used to the hard way," he says. I have grown used to being blasted with chemotherapy drugs. But that's not what he's trying to say. He knows I'm hooked on the hard way. "I'd rather you kill me trying to cure me," I tell him. And there is a long silence afterward. We both know what he should say, and I'm grateful that he doesn't. They are not trying to cure me. I'm not going to get to the top of the mountain. He has been trying to lower my drug dosage, space things out, and ease up a little on the regimen, but he knows this is tough for me. I liked the idea that I was doing the harshest thing, that I was really getting somewhere. But now it's time for me to accept something harder, that I'm not sure I'm going to be able to do the extreme treatment much longer. My treatment has been like a journey swinging on 3 vines. 2 of these vines are chemotherapy drugs, and 1 is the immunotherapy drug. I already had to stop one chemotherapy drug because I was losing all feeling in my hands and feet. Snip. And now I'm thinking about cutting out the other chemotherapy drug. I'll be swinging on that one immunotherapy vine, hoping it holds me up. Please, God, make it work. So, if we stop chemotherapy now and my tumors grow, I say uncertainly, then we can restart chemotherapy. Worst case scenario, your tumors grow 20% by the next scan, he says quickly. But if the immunotherapy drug doesn't work, then I'm going to die anyway. My voice sounds flat and matter-of-fact, even to me. Right? I mean, the chemo drugs are already fading. He is trying to reassure me, but I can't quite hear the words. I'm staring at my hands, puffed with chemotoxins and the color of rhubarb. I have come to the end of what I know how to do. I know how to suffer. I know how to make the best of things. But I don't know how to do the most basic thing. I don't know how to stop. I want to stop taking these chemotherapy drugs. But what if that's the beginning of my decline? What if I need to keep going a little longer? How will I know when I can stop? I am sitting across from the man who won a huge prize for his discovery of my particular form of cancer, the cell disorder that caused these tumors to bloom. For all his many efforts, his thousands of hours in the lab, I have brought him cupcakes. With sprinkles. We have both, as it turns out, spent a lot of time walking up to the edges of things, and we are talking about what it means to face facts. I'm not sure I want to know what happens if I stop chemotherapy, but at the same time, I want to get it over with, I confess. What would you do? I'd go to work, he says, and I realize the weight of what he is saying. His office is plain and sensible, which confirms something I already know about him 5 minutes into our conversation. He has suffered and is there to work. In what were the worst moments of his life, he put one foot in front of the other. He tasked himself with a series of responsibilities that ultimately gave me back this year, and maybe many more. But what I loved more than anything was that he did it without knowing it would matter. He marched forward because it was the best he could do. We're all terminal, he says simply, and it answers my unspoken question. How do you stop? You just stop. You come to the end of yourself, and then you take a deep breath, and say a prayer, and get back to work. I have had cancer for a full year now. I called my mom before the surgery 1 year ago today. Frank told me the secret, I said to her. But the more my mom pressed for details, the more it was obvious that I was on a lot of exciting painkillers, and that I had forgotten the secret entirely. I had asked him about heaven. He knew what I was asking because he always knows. Will I be connected? Will I miss everything? Will I see my son sprout up and learn the rules of Canadian football? Can I see him graduate and be launched into the world? How many times can I sit beside his bed and watch his eyes squeeze tight as we thank God for tractors and the sticks we throw into the stream near our house? These are the plans I have made. These are the hopes that are being ground into dust. And then one day, out of the blue, I remembered what he said next. Don't skip to the end, he said gently. Don't skip to the end. What do you think I meant by that? Frank said to me last week, sitting in my office. He can't remember saying it because that day was such a blur. We are marveling at a whole year gone by. A whole year that the doctors said I had a 30% chance of surviving. I think you meant that we just can't know. And that our brains fill in all the details, for good or for ill. We want to tell ourselves a story, any story, so we can get back to certainty, I reply. You know me. I am so desperate to know what's going to happen. At least so I can prepare. I sound really deep, he says. I just need to make it to 50. I need to make sure that kid is launched. I need to get most of my life done. I need to lock it down. But it comes undone. There are so many times in life when we think we have it locked down, he says. We are quiet again. Plans are made. Plans come apart. New delights or tragedies pop up in their place. And nothing human or divine will map out this life. This life that has been more painful than I could have imagined. More beautiful than I could have imagined. Right. That's the secret. Don't skip to the end. I remind myself, sheepishly wiping my face on the sleeve of my sweater. My friend Corey, daytime pastor and nighttime comedian, has bought a subscription to an online life enrichment course for way too much money. It seemed like such a great idea. Let's get focused. But now it sits unused in her iPhone downloads to the tune of $600. Want to do my life-changing, goal-oriented online course with me? Asks Corey. She is the kind of person who owns her own portable photo booth with buckets of props, so that every time she appears, poof, it's a party. But I am the worst at this stuff now. I can't make plans. And geez, my life is already too meaningful, I protest. But think of all the fun we'll have creating our time management diaries and logging our hours spent watching American Ninja Warrior. She's right. We watch an Olympic amount of reality television. And at first, the course assignments are not too bad. I give up a time-consuming game on my phone and agree to read more at night. But soon, the daily tasks get down to the bones of my life, telling me to make concrete plans to improve my health this year, and then make a plan for 5 years from now. 5 years? I text Corey. I don't know. I guess my big goal is not to die. What about your horrible spinach drink? She asks. I can drink the horrible spinach drink. Great, and take your vitamins, she chirps. The course keeps asking me to define my life philosophy, and I'm not sure what to say. I want to communicate in my actions and my words that I'm living, but I'm aware of the reality of death. I think it's something like living well, grieving well, I say uncertainly. Oh, absolutely not, she said. That all sounds very serious and proper when you say it like that. Fine. No living well, grieving well. How about your motto should be, balls out living, balls out grieving, she ventures. When she says it, I love her more. She never treats me as if I'm rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic, or tacitly suggests I could save myself with my new juicing machine. She helps me walk the line between total passivity and supercharged heroic effort. But mostly she understands that the best thing she can do is order Canadian props for my patriotic Canadian Thanksgiving party and pray for me like a champion. As we plug along with this life course, the assignments get harder. What are the goals for your primary relationships? It asks. What qualities do you want to foster in them? What thing do you want them to know with all their hearts? I write Tobin's and Zach's names down on a blank sheet in my notebook and find myself circling their names with endless hearts. How can I have goals for these relationships in a future that might never come? Exhausted, I stuffed the notebook into the bottom of my bag. But the questions are sticking to me. On long walks, in hospital waiting rooms, in moments before sleep, what do I want to give them? I have taken the notebook back out and scribbled a couple of words. Compassion. That one is for Zach. I have always wanted to raise a boy who loves the underdog, who stops for snails, who wants to know why the man outside the car window says he will work for food. I want to raise a tough softy. He will know the pain of the world, but all will be better for it. He will be brave in the face of heartbreak. For Tobin, I write a word, and then I shake my head. It is impossible. Joy. How can I ask a man who might lose his wife, the mother of his son, and his best friend since middle school, to feel something close to joy? Sometimes we play a game called What Don't I Know About You? And the answer is always so specific that no one else can play. I recently learned that he had played the bass clarinet in grade 7, and I shrieked, "How did I not know this? Who are you?" I know everything. He knows everything. How can anything good live in the space that death would make? As the question turns in my mind, my hand begins to scribble. The page is filling with words, ideas, little tidbits of something I wasn't sure I knew how to do anymore. I am making plans. I am living in ordinary time. I can take care of Zach on a Saturday, so Tobin can take his dirt bike out on the back roads. I can buy him chocolates at every weird stop where my research takes me and put them by his desk. I can lay his arm on my knee while we watch television and trace tickly lines from his wrist to his elbow. I can run my hands through his hair and tell him that he is growing more inappropriately beautiful year by year and remind him of the time that he looked identical to an advertisement for sunglasses. I can tell his family and friends, quietly, that in case I don't survive, I want them to know that the greatest truth about us is that I need him to be happy, remake his life, marry if he likes, and, as soon as possible, surprise himself by how hard he can laugh. I buy him a huge sign that reads, "You are my bucket list," and hang it in our living room. My little plans are crumbs scattered on the ground. This is all I have learned about living here, plodding along and finding God. My well-laid plans are no longer my foundation. I can only hope that my dreams, my actions, my hopes are leaving a trail for Zach and Tobin, so whichever way the path turns, all they will find is love. Zach is beside me in our big bed as I write these words, rolling around like a polar bear cub. After we take him out of his crib in the morning, he loves to come up to our loft bedroom and loll around like only 2-year-olds can. It's another beautiful morning, and it's time to yell with the pitch of the coffee grinder and make him French toast. I will die, yes, but not today. Appendix 1. Absolutely never say this to people experiencing terrible times. A short list. 1. Well, at least...
Whoa, hold up there.
Were you about to make a comparison?
At least it's not, what, stage 5 cancer? Don't minimize.
2. In my long life, I've learned that...
Geez, do you want a medal? I get it. You lived forever.
Well, some people are worried that they won't, or that things are so hard they won't want to.
So ease up on the life lessons.
Life is a privilege, not a reward. 3. It's going to get better. I promise.
Well, fairy godmother, that's going to be a tough row to hoe when things go badly.
4. God needed an angel. This one takes the cake because A, it makes God look sadistic and needy, and B, angels are, according to Christian tradition, created from scratch, not dead people looking for a cameo in Ghost. You see how confusing it is when we just pretend that the deceased return to help you find your car keys or make pottery? 5. Everything happens for a reason. The only thing worse than saying this is pretending that you know the reason. I've had hundreds of people tell me the reason for my cancer. Because of my sin. Because of my unfaithfulness. Because God is fair. Because God is unfair. Because of my aversion to Brussels sprouts. I mean, no one is short of reasons. So if people tell you this, make sure you are there when they go through the cruelest moments of their lives. And start offering your own. When someone is drowning, the only thing worse than failing to throw them a life preserver is handing them a reason. 6. I've done some research and... I thought I should listen to my oncologist and my nutritionist and my team of specialists, but it turns out that I should be listening to you. Yes, please! Tell me more about the medical secrets that only one flaxseed provider in Orlando knows. Wait. Let me get a pen. 7. When my aunt had cancer... My darling dear, I know you are trying to relate to me. Now you see me and you are reminded that terrible things have happened in the world. But guess what? That is where I live, in the valley of the shadow of death. But now I'm on vacation because I'm not in the hospital or dealing with my mess. Do I have to take my sunglasses off and join you in the saddest journey down memory lane? Or do you mind if I finish my mojito? 8. So how are the treatments going? How are you really? This is the toughest one of all. I can hear you trying to understand my world and be on my side. But picture the worst thing that has ever happened to you. Got it? Now try to put it in a sentence. Now say it aloud 50 times a day. Does your head hurt? Do you feel sad? Me too. So let's just see if I want to talk about it today, because sometimes I do, and sometimes I want a hug and a recap of American Ninja Warrior. Appendix 2. Give this a go. See how it works. A short list. 1. I'd love to bring you a meal this week. Can I email you about it? Oh, thank goodness. I am starving, but mostly I can never figure out something to tell people that I need, even if I need it. But really, bring me anything. Chocolate, a potted plant, a set of weird erasers. I remember the first gift I got that wasn't about cancer, and I was so happy I cried. Send me funny emails filled with YouTube clips to watch during chemotherapy. Do something that suits your gifts. But most important, bring me presents. 2. You are a beautiful person. Unless you are of the opposite gender and used to speaking in a creepy, windowless van kind of voice, comments like this go a long way. Everyone wants to know they are doing a good job without feeling like they are learning a lesson. So tell your friend something about his life that you admire, without making it feel like a eulogy. 3. I am so grateful to hear about how you are doing, and just know that I'm on your team. You mean I don't have to give you an update? You asked someone else for all the gory details? Phew!
Great.
Now I get to feel like you are both informed and concerned. So don't gild the lily. What you have said is amazing. So don't screw it up now by being a nosy Nelly. Ask a question about any other aspect of my life. 4. Can I give you a hug? Some of my best moments with people have come with a hug or a hand on the arm. People who are suffering often, not always, feel isolated and want to be touched. Hospitals and big institutions in general tend to treat people like cyborgs or throwaways. So ask if your friend feels up for a hug and give her some sugar. 5. Oh, my friend, that sounds so hard. Perhaps the weirdest thing about having something awful happen is the fact that no one wants to hear about it. People tend to want to hear the summary, but they don't usually want to hear it from you, and that it was awful. So simmer down and let them talk for a bit. Be willing to stare down the ugliness and sadness. Life is absurdly hard, and pretending it isn't is exhausting. 6. Silence. The truth is that no one knows what to say. It's awkward. Pain is awkward. Tragedy is awkward. People's weird, suffering bodies are awkward. But take the advice of one man who wrote to me with his policy. Show up and shut up. A final public service announcement to suffering people. Just remember that if cancer or divorce or tragedies of all kinds don't kill you, people's good intentions will. Take the phrase, "but they mean well," as your cue to run screaming from the room. Or demand presents. You deserve a break. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Everything Happens for a Reason and Other Lies I've Loved. This program was directed by Paula Parker. Executive producer, Karen Jaconsky. Text copyright 2018 by Kate Bowler. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.